We are learning more about what led to the sinking of the doomed cargo ship, the El Faro. Good morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9, and thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. We are always live at 9 and never miss a show. Download the WJCT app and listen to us there anytime or on iTunes. You can stream us live right now on Facebook, too. Just ahead, new information is out into the sinking of the El Faro. We'll examine the latest information released from the National Transportation Safety Board and take your calls. The number to get on the line with us is 549-2937. Then later, just a few more hours till the big moment as the nation watches the Great American Eclipse. We'll go live to South Carolina, where thousands are flocking to get the best possible look at it. Plus, Culpepper on a simmering quarterback controversy for the Jaguars. All of that and more ahead this morning. But first this hour, we've got new information into the sinking of the El Faro. The NTSB on Friday released several new documents and reports into its ongoing investigation into the doomed cargo ship. Now, the El Faro sank near the Bahamas in October of 2015 on a route from Jacksonville to Puerto Rico. The ship sailed right into the path of Hurricane Joaquin, and all 33 on board died. Now, the report just out details how managers at Tote Maritime, that's the company that owned El Faro, repeatedly told investigators that the captain of the ship could make any and all decisions related to the ship's operations. The report also contained text messages and emails from the captain showing that he was aware of the impending storm but didn't think it would cause too much trouble. And that's just part of what we're learning. Attorney and maritime expert Rod Sullivan represented the family of one of the men who died aboard the El Faro. That case has since been settled. And he joins us now in studio with more. Rod, always good to see you. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Melissa.
Here's our question to callers. What are your questions and thoughts about the new information we're getting about the tragedy of the doomed cargo ship, the El Faro? The NTSB came out with more information on this Friday. Give us a call with your thoughts and questions for our maritime expert, Rod Sullivan. It's 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online, send your emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org, tweets to @MelissaInJax, or you can weigh in on Facebook. Lots of information in this report. It's called a wreckage trajectory study, looking at a number of factors into the crash. A second report was called the human factor, all the decisions that were made, not just the data and the technology. What are the most striking findings you're seeing from this new information, Rod?
Well, I think for the average person, I think the human factors report is really the more interesting. And what it does is it gives us a first look into the communications that we didn't actually get to see before because they were all taken in by the NTSB and then kept private or kept secret. So now we know, for example, that the second mate who was ashore sent text messages to the captain recommending other routes to take through the Bahamas to avoid the storm. Now, we knew that the VDR transcript contained warnings from the second mate and the third mate in particular and concerns by the chief mate that they were heading so close to the storm. But this report brings out all the most salient portions of those conversations. So if you didn't want to read the 500 pages of transcript,
right,
this is like the Cliff Notes version. It takes
sure
up all the most interesting parts.
As you noted, this human report notes that there was a discussion of Tote's motto, on time, every time. So the captain and his crew were under a lot of pressure to meet a deadline and arrive on time, even if they had to go through a hurricane to do it.
Exactly. I mean, put yourself in the shoes of this captain. He initially had been told that he would be out of a job once the El Faro was laid up. And then in August, they said, well, we're going to reconsider and we're going to re-interview you for the new liquefied natural gas ships that are coming out. And then from August through the time that the ship sunk, he was in limbo. He didn't know whether he'd get the job or not. So he's got to be there worried, you know, if I turn this ship around, if I cost the company $100,000 by coming in 6, 8, or 12 hours later, I'm never going to get that job. And I think that was in the back of his mind the entire time he's making his decisions.
There was also crew fatigue as a factor. Can you tell us what we've learned there?
I was quite frankly amazed at the number of hours that the crew was working. The average workload for an officer was 13 hours a day. The average workload for an unlicensed person was 11 hours hours a day. And when they looked back through the records, the third mate, for example, had violated the sleep rest work schedule four times during the past, I think it was 2 years before the accident. The second mate was taking ZQL so that she could sleep during her off hours, but was that really wearing off when she came on duty? So it really, these folks were working hard.
It's new information into the sinking of the Al Faro. We'll go to your calls in a moment. 549-2937 is the number to join us. Okay, the NTSB in this report also commented that when a competitor, Horizon Lines, went out of business in 2014, Tote's business in the Puerto Rican trade increased by 10%. Is that significant?
Well, it's significant, and it's actually inaccurate. The NTSB takes Tote at its word with a lot of things that they say, and I'm sure they said it was 10%, but then a few pages later, they show the actual cargo volume, and the actual cargo volume was 30% higher. The fact is the El Faro had more cargo on this voyage than it had ever carried in its recent history. And you have a 41-year-old ship, you're subjecting it to these stresses that might be good for a 10-year-old ship, but were not good for a 41-year-old ship. And I think that contributed to this entire incident.
What else sticks out at you?
Well, I tell you what I was shocked about, and they didn't really discuss what happened in the engine room too much, but I was shocked at how little experience the third engineers on the ship had. One of these third engineers had never been on a steamship before he signed on this vessel a day before it sank. The other had 8 days of experience on a steamship. They had the licenses to do the job, but they hadn't worked on this type of ship. And the difference between working on a ship that's diesel-powered and working on a ship that's steam-powered is like the difference between driving an automatic transmission and a standard transmission. You really don't know how to drive a standard transmission car because you read about it or you've taken a test on it.
That's a good analogy.
And in this case, when they lose the plant, that's something that just happens to steam plants, and you don't know how to get a plant back online if you've never served on a steamship before.
Not only that, the report shows that the captain's first and second mates were sort of differing with him about the safety of going through into this storm. They couldn't be insubordinate, though, correct?
Right. Everybody, quite frankly. I mean, the chief mate was the one who was most or least critical. The third mate, Mr. Ream, is somebody who what they call came up through the hawse pipe. He started out as an able-bodied seaman and worked his way up to being a third mate. He was extremely competent. Everybody complimented him, but he was very, he gave the captain a lot of reports, and when the captain didn't follow his advice, he was sort of vocal to the AB. And then the second mate, Danielle Randolph, also gave him reports. And then the captain said, we're going to keep going. I don't care that we're going to be 22 miles from the center of the storm. And she turned around to her AB after she hung up the phone and says, well, AB says, hold on to your buttocks. Because, and I'm, of course, cleaning that up for your audience. But, she also thought that they were in some really rough weather. So he had plenty of warning. He had plenty of people who were suggesting he take a different route, and he simply plowed on ahead.
How will the El Faro change the maritime shipping industry?
Well, a couple of ways. First of all, there's something called a designated person ashore who's supposed to be monitoring these vessels. This DP had 14 vessels to monitor. You really cannot effectively monitor and follow, in my opinion, 14 different vessels. So I think that's one thing that might change. The one thing that hasn't been discussed yet is life-saving. You know, ships sink all the time. There are roughly a ship sinks somewhere in the world every 3 days. What doesn't happen is we don't often lose all crew members from a ship that sinks. And so the question that I have here is, how come nobody got off? There was only one person found in an immersion suit. Why didn't anybody have their immersion suits on? Why was nobody able to get into a life raft? And should they have upgraded this equipment and not allowed the ship to be grandfathered in with 41-year-old equipment on it?
If you're just tuning in, the NTSB released more information into the sinking of the El Faro. The Jacksonville cargo ship went down in the path of Hurricane Joaquin. Nearly 2 years ago, all 33 Jacksonville crew on board died in that tragedy. What are your questions for Maritime Attorney Rod Sullivan? 549-2937. Jody on the South Side. Hey, Jody, good morning.
Good morning. I missed a little bit of the introduction, so you may have touched on this, but I remember hearing something about a timing problem in terms of the transmission of information to the captain, or even to the clearing point for that information, a delay be caused by technology or something. And I'm wondering if, as we go through this and we're deciding what the captain knew and didn't know, that whether he was making decisions based on insufficient or, you know, inaccurate information that wasn't coming to him in a timely manner.
Sure.
That's a very good point. You know, our local weathermen have actually weighed in on this, and Tim Deegan from First Coast News had some very interesting comments, which were, why are they using something like BVS, the Bon Voyage system, which is delayed by 8 hours, when they're in the position that they can watch the Weather Channel on TV? Mm-hmm. They can get National Weather Service forecasts themselves over the radio. And why do you rely upon a third-party service? And as you read the transcript, you saw that they were getting a lot of weather information. The captain says, well, we got 5 different GPS positions. Yeah, but they also showed that they were passing perilously close to where the hurricane was going to be. I think if you're going to take a lesson from this, it's you probably need to rely upon the contemporaneous services that are free rather than spend a lot of money for a service which is going to be 8 hours delayed.
Has TOTE changed protocol about sailing into the path of a storm? I mean, or will the industry change their protocol?
I don't know if they've changed their protocol. I would say this, you know, they have 2 new ships. They've retired all these old ships. The new ships are the most modern and the most expensive ships ever built in the United States merchant fleet, and they have all the best equipment, and they have none of the captains on the old ships, by the way, got captain slots on the new ships. So they were looking for younger, I don't know how to put it, but they were looking for a different set of captains. And I think, you know, hindsight's 20/20. I don't think we'll see anybody make this same mistake again.
549-2937. Let's hope so. Robert is in Atlantic Beach now. Hey, Robert, good morning to you.
Good morning. I have a comment and 2 questions. As a seagoing tugboat captain, my comment on using the weather routing services is they're great for planning a week in advance, but they're no good for 48 hours and less. I have 2 questions. First question is, why did NTSB not talk about why the captain chose to take that particular route and the politics of TOTE? And my second question is, has there actually been any physical evidence saying that the grandfathering of the survival equipment contributed to crew deaths? I mean, we did find parts of the lifeboat which were floating. So the lifeboat did its job, apparently. Thank you.
Yeah. Actually, these are really perceptive questions. It's good to talk to somebody from the industry. I'd like to answer the second one first. We do have physical evidence that they weren't able to get into the lifeboats. If you look at the pictures of the El Faro sitting on the floor of the ocean, you will notice that the pilot ladder is located on the 4th deck, the boat deck, or 1 deck above the boat deck. If you notice on the testimony, it was on the main deck when the ship left port. Well, how did it get from the main deck 4 decks up? Somebody had to carry it up. Why would they carry it up? They would carry it up because they needed to get down into the lifeboats. When the ship is listing over 15 degrees, the outboard lifeboat is hanging so far away from the hull that you cannot jump into it. You have to lower yourself down. The inboard lifeboat is sliding down the hull, makes it very hard to get in. The other thing we notice is that there are lines tied from the railings on the main deck down to the waterline. Why would somebody do that? Well, the only reason you would do that is if you wanted to lower yourself down the side of the hull in order to try to get into a lifeboat or to get into the water. Now, these immersion suits are not designed for impact. If you dive more than or jump more than 12 feet into the water, your feet go through the bottom and you lose the watertight integrity of the immersion suits. The drop from the deck of the El Faro down to the waterline was over 25 feet. So these are the kind of this is the kind of evidence we have.
The full report coming out later this year, but based on what we know now, I hate to use this kind of tired phrase, but it really was a perfect storm of bad events all coming together at once, it sounds like.
Yeah, one of the things I've learned in practicing maritime law is that major disasters never happen through a single act of negligence. It really needs to be a culmination of a number of different things that come together at once to cause an accident like this. And that's what we had here. Everything between the stress on the captain from not knowing whether he had a job or not, the age of the ship, the weather conditions, all
the pressure
combined. The pressure to be on time, and all of these things together combined to produce this disaster, which is, you know, why we'll hopefully never see one of these again, or at least we'll not see one for quite a substantial period of time.
You represented one of the families. That case is settled. A number of actions were brought into this tragedy. What's it likely to cost the company overall when it's all said and done?
Well, see, I've signed a confidentiality agreement, so I can't really tell you how much the settlements are. I do want to dispel the idea that the settlements were $500,000, because $500,000 was the amount that Tote was willing to pay everybody for pain and suffering as a result of the loss of life. But that didn't compensate them for their loss of support. So, for example, if a seaman was married to his spouse, by the way, being married in this context is very important. It doesn't matter how long you live with each other. If you don't have a license, you're not entitled to claim. But if a man was married to his wife, had a number of children, was providing them with support, for a mother or father, you added up their loss of income over their entire life, and then you reduce that to present value, meaning if you invested it in bonds, how much money would you have? And then that was the amount of damages. And I'm going to be quite honest with you. I think Tote was very fair with the people in the settlements they had. If they hadn't been fair with my client, we wouldn't have settled. So you shouldn't think that they just got $500,000, but beyond that, I can't tell you how much they got. It's going to cost them a ton.
Yeah.
Yeah. As a matter of fact, this is such a big claim that it's not really only Tote's insurance company that's covering it. This became a consortium of insurance companies all around the world that made up this pool that paid the settlements.
Mm. Just a huge blow for the industry and for Jacksonville.
Yeah, it's a huge blow for Jacksonville. But on the flip side, if you go on a Sunday morning, you will see the most modern ship in the American merchant fleet sailing out of Jacksonville. These liquefied natural gas ships, have the lowest pollution profile because they're burning a fuel that's about 60 to 70% as much carbon as the old ships did. They've got all the modern equipment. They've got the best trained crews, and therefore, the industry is the safety of the industry is on the upswing.
That is at least one silver lining to this.
It is.
He is Jacksonville attorney and maritime expert Rod Sullivan. The full NTSB report on the sinking of the El Faro is expected to be released a little later this year. Rod, always good to see you. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Melissa.
Much more still ahead later. Culpepper on a quarterback controversy gripping the Jaguars. We'll tell you about it. But up next, the nation waits for the big moment, a total solar eclipse. We've got a live report straight from the path of totality in South Carolina. That's next.
Brookdale Cypress Village, a continuing care retirement community, features apartments and homes surrounded by lakes and walking trails, minutes from the beach, town center, and adjacent to the Mayo Clinic. 223-6100.
Dr. Galani with Galani Vision Institute, for over 25 years committed to offering second opinions for corrective LASIK and cataract eye surgery. Are you a candidate for new corrective techniques? Learn more at galanivision.com. Vision for the world.
Presidents are expected to serve as moral leaders, but after Charlottesville, many are turning to their spiritual leaders. Some of these faith communities have fought racism and anti-Semitism before. How much are we hearing from America's faith leaders? Or how little? What are they saying? And who's listening? Next time on 1A.
Weekdays at 10 after First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
Hi, I'm Mayor Lenny Curry. Knowing your evacuation zone is critical for your safety in a weather emergency. Visit a public library to get your 2017 Hurricane Preparedness Guide. Stay informed with real-time updates at jaxready.com or download the Jax Ready app to also identify your specific zone and important information. Keep your radio on 89.9, the designated emergency broadcaster for Northeast Florida.
This segment is brought to you by GuideWell Insurance Agency, exclusively serving members of Florida Blue.
On the next Fresh Air, how a young Winston Churchill earned distinction and tested his mettle in war.
He wanted to be in the most difficult, most dangerous battles he could find, and he wanted to be noticed. He wanted to stand out.
We speak with Candace Millard about her new book, Hero of the Empire, The Boer War, A Daring Escape, and the Making of Winston Churchill. Join us.
Weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
Welcome back. Well, the great moment is almost upon us. America woke up this morning ready to turn its eyes to the sky. The day of the great American eclipse has finally arrived. Now, across the country, there's a last-minute scramble to view the solar eclipse. Millions are expected to converge along the 70-mile-wide Path of Totality, as it's called. It stretches from Oregon to South Carolina. That's where you will see a total eclipse. Eclipses truly inspire awe. Over the centuries, they've spawned myths, altered belief systems, even reshaped the way entire civilizations saw their world. Here in the modern era, this eclipse will be the first in a century to cross the continental United States from coast to coast, and the first since the Republic's foundation that will pass directly over only this country. How about that? It's a big deal. WJCT producer Carlos Bouvier sure thinks so. He hit the road this morning, and he's up in South Carolina somewhere right now to view the eclipse along the Path of Totality. He's on the phone with us right now to give us a live report on what he's seeing. Hey, Carlos, good morning.
Good morning, Melissa, and good morning to the audience.
Hey, so where are you in South Carolina right now?
I am in a little town named San Mateus, and it's about 30 miles from I-95, west of I-95. And the dead center of totality is going to go over the town. So it doesn't, nowhere in the totality area will be as dark as it's going to be here in San Mateus. So it's a pretty exciting time.
Oh, it is, I'm sure. Now, describe what you're seeing. How many people are on the highways? What's it like in the town?
To tell you the truth, the highway was pretty clean all the way here. I traveled in the middle of the night, and then I took some state roads. And you can see some people camping in open areas along the state roads. But I hear from residents here that most of the people, it's in camping areas like parks. Not particularly in the city. There are not that many hotels in this area. Since I arrived about 3 hours ago, I see traffic mounting and mounting. You can see tags from Michigan, New York, New Jersey, Florida. A lot of people from Florida. I was talking about with the people from Fort Lauderdale that they drove all the way here. It's kind of like the excitement is mounting as more and more people arrive.
Oh, I'm sure. It's amazing how many people from around the world will travel to see this. That's what interested you as well. You're going to produce a video piece, correct?
Correct. I'm working on it. But, you know, but more than anything, it's a personal experience. I think anybody will be really touched by what's going to happen today. If it's here just going from day to night, to date again, in a matter of minutes, you know, you can feel the awesome power of nature upon you. So it's going to be a great time. And I tell you what, all the way here, I was singing that song from Cat Stevens. I've been followed by the moon shadow. It was phenomenal. It kept me awake all night long.
Oh, yeah, exactly. All those songs are going through people's heads. Now, how are they handling all of the crowds in this little town?
Well, it's mounted by the minute, and you can tell traffic coming and coming and coming. I see police officers from the town driving around, Actually, I tried to stop one of them, but there was so much traffic that they had to keep going. But, you know, everything seems very quiet here. The people that is coming down there, everybody's really relaxed, and you can tell everybody's like had smiley faces. You know, it's a very, everybody's in a very positive mood. And I talked to some of the residents here that, you know, how do they feel about getting all these thousands of people coming down to town? And they were pretty excited about it. I think they don't get this much attention, at least here in San Mateo, right?
Yeah, sure. Looking at today's Florida Times Union, they report that we have to go all the way back to 1970 to see this much excitement over an eclipse. People came out for a big eclipse that year, and they were told that they would have to wait all the way until 2017 to see anything like this again, and it seems so far off in the future. And now here we are. Back in 1970, they had traffic jams, all kinds of excitement. Jacksonville was really close to the path of totality on March 7th, 1970, and lots of eclipse watchers came here, all the mania over it, and here we are again. What about this interests you so much, Carlos? You're really excited, I can tell.
I think just the awesome power of nature, you know, just to be in the shadow, and you know it's the shadow of the moon. You don't get that every day. And I think the experience is a very physical, too, in the sense that temperature is going to drop. There are a lot of mosquitoes already. So when they sense that it's nighttime, they're all going to come out. All around us, when we are in the totality part of the eclipse, we're going to see kind of like a sunrise 360 degrees around us, right? Because that's how it's going to look like. Now it's a little bit cloudy. It's not bad. It's kind of like patchy. But, you know, hopefully, but later today it will be nice and clear.
Hopefully so, yeah. I think we're all hoping for that. And do you plan to drive back tonight?
Yes. I probably hang out for a little bit to let traffic go, because what I hear from residents is in other towns closer to I-95, especially here in this area, there's a little town, it's called Santee, and that area was already pretty packed. And they were expecting about 100,000 people. We're talking about a town of 1,500 people. So that's quite a crowd for them. And that's the access back to I-95. So I'll probably hang out here for a little bit in an hour or so and then head back home.
All right. Well, drive safely and enjoy. It's exciting and so good to hear from you this morning. Have fun up there, Carlos.
Thank you, Melissa. I appreciate it. Sure, I will.
He's our own Carlos Bouvier, producer and videographer for WJCT. We'll have his video piece on the eclipse up on our website later this week at wjctnews.org. A total eclipse of the heart, of the moon, of the sun. We'll be right back.
Now I'm only falling apart. There's nothing I can do. A total eclipse of the heart. Once upon a time there was light in my life, but now there's only love in the dark. Nothing I can say. A total eclipse of the heart.
John and Mary Lou Missel are authors of the new book, The Army Is My Calling, The Life and Writings of Major John Rogers Vinton, 1801 to 1847. I'm Ben Brotmarkle, and coming up on Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, we'll discuss Vinton, who served during the Second Seminole War. We'll talk about sugar cultivation and learning from space program disasters. That's Florida Frontiers, Monday evening at 6:30 on 89.9 WJCT.
Well, here's something. It's possible for somebody to impersonate you and buy a bunch of stuff on your credit card just by hacking into your phone.
When I really knew something was wrong and put everything together was a couple hours later when all of a sudden my texting wouldn't work.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Account theft, it's called. It's next time on Marketplace.
Weekday evenings at 6 on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
Take a drive with us into the Blues Horizon, the best in classic and modern blues, as part of WJCT's After Hours, tonight at 11 on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world, your music.
Judges are confirming what listeners already know. The WJCT News team is among the best in the nation and the state of Florida. This year, WJCT News took home national awards for Best Arts Reporting and Best Talk Show, as well as statewide honors including Best Newscast and Best Continuing Coverage. For excellent journalism, stick with WJCTNews.org and 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world, your news.
Welcome back. Well, while most people think of our beaches as involving sun, sand, and surf, there's something else going on at the beaches, a global branding initiative. And it will support everything from exports from Palestine to the consumption of locally produced goods and services in Malawi. Also, brand development is happening in Georgia, not our neighbor to the north, but the Republic of Georgia. That's the country on the eastern coast of the Black Sea, just south of Russia. And how about branding initiatives all developed at the beach for enterprises spanning from Ghana to Serbia, Montenegro, Colombia, Australia, and more? Currently celebrating 40 years of specializing in branding for a number of big companies and countries, the firm Studio Spear has some stories to tell. Jeff Spear is the president of Studio Spear and joins us this morning. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. Thanks for having me.
A global branding agency based in Jacksonville Beach, and I tend to think of Studio Spear as being all about food branding, but it's not just that.
No, it depends on the assignments we're given, where we go. Right now in Palestine, we're working with every industrial sector that they've got. So we're working with stone and marble. We're working with information and communications technology. And there's agriculture. I mean, even some of the work we did in Jacksonville, we worked in healthcare. In Australia, we worked with shoes. So it varies. I mean, the food part is really fun, and it's in many cases it's interesting and delicious. So, mm-hmm. it's a better story. But we work with just about every sector imaginable.
When you say Palestine, as Americans, we tend to think of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Mm. But there's more happening in that land than strife and conflict.
Yeah, and that's,
you've been brought in to do what?
Well, that's the issue. Is that when most people hear the name Palestine, they think conflict. It's global. And the problem is that Palestine produces some wonderful stuff. I looked at their stone and marble industry and saw computer-aided design. It's water jet carving of stone. This is state-of-the-art stuff. I walked into this factory, and it might as well have been Star Wars. I mean, it's just so contemporary. Fascinating stuff, and some of the growers of herbs and the communications technologies. I mean, this is state-of-the-art stuff. Mm-hmm. And people don't know that there are actually very good, very productive, very positive stories coming out of Palestine. So what we're doing from a branding initiative is trying to insert some of those stories into the dialogue so it's not always about conflict.
And how do you do that, whether it's Palestine or, say, Malawi? That's another country you're working in.
Malawi's a little bit of a different story. Malawi was, they're just very poor. It's one of the poorest places on the globe. And we were helping, they have a trade imbalance. The better stuff comes from other countries. And Malawi makes some good stuff. And so it's how do we get just even Malawians to recognize what's good in the country and to buy it? Instead of buying Pringles, buy the locally made chips. Instead of buying imported sugar, buy the locally grown stuff. It's actually fascinating what isn't bought domestically. I mean, even here, people are promoting, buy local, buy local. Over there, in most of the countries I work in, that buy local attitude is becoming more prevalent because it's important to local economy.
Sure. Yeah. Now, you go all over the world. It's amazing the number of countries you have done work in. How did that develop for Studio Spear?
I do a lot of public speaking, and as a result of one of the conferences that I spoke at, someone came up to me, and this was years ago, and this is when the internet was still being developed and Google Earth didn't exist, and someone called me, and they said, "Hey, Jeff, how'd you like to do some label design in Serbia. And I'm thinking to myself, two things went through my head. One of them I can't repeat because it's too explicit, but it was basically, yeah, let's go.
Uh-huh.
And the other is, where's Serbia?
Where's Serbia?
And so nowadays when I get calls, I mean, I remember I got a call from someone. They said they wanted me to do work in Ghana, and this is doing work with their Ministry of Finance. And they said Guyana, I heard Ghana, and fortunately Google Earth existed. And then when these calls come, I pull up the country very quickly. And I go, oh, that's South America. Great. Puedo hablar en español. Mm-hmm. And then I find out it's the only English-speaking country on the continent.
Uh-huh.
So there was no Spanish, but it was interesting.
So your brand has expanded around the world, it sounds like, due to word of mouth.
Yeah. These days, I mean, I know where the assignments are. There are agencies in every developed country you can think of that are providing assistance to these countries that are, you know, considered emerging economies. When I was just in Palestine, Germany was there, U.S. was there, Britain was there. I was on a British contract. Japan had a huge presence. And in Malawi, where there are donor organizations all over the place, it's almost like the donor countries are competing for attention and want to help. And it's a great thing to bring the money in. But you also get a culture that's reliant on donor funding, and that can be a problem.
Now, I did not know this, but your first big assignment was to create the logo for Michael Jackson's Bad album.
Yeah,
Is that right?
That was a watershed event for us. It was years ago. I actually don't like talking about it too much, but it's an iconic logo. And last week, I get an email, and every now and then this happens. I get an email from Spain, and it's this fan of Michael Jackson. And he's getting a tattoo, and would I send him the artwork for the logo, and would I modify it? And I forget what he wanted it to say, but I said, look, the inker that you go to for the tattoo will be able to take the style and give you something nice. But he wanted me to create an artwork that used the bad, but also some extra words. You know, so every now and then, Jackson has a huge fan base, and they're very loyal, and they're very,
sure.
they're not going anywhere in any time soon.
And it's interesting to think that you started making logos for rock stars and also clients of American companies like Disney, Anheuser-Busch. Now you're making logos and branding for countries.
Yeah. People tell me that they say, Jeff, what you do is so cool. And, you know, I'm in the middle of it. And so I don't really see the cool. For me, it's my work. I appreciate the exotic nature of it. I mean, I'm going to places that I would never spend a dime to go on vacation. And so I still remember, I have vivid memories of crossing the bridge into downtown Niger or downtown Niamey in Niger, and there's a hippo in the water. You know, you don't see that crossing the Main Street Bridge going, you know,
sure.
crossing the Jacksonville River, the St. John's River. You know, there are a lot of things that I encounter that are very cool. And so when I get to work on these country brands, it's a very interesting, they're all very interesting engagements for very different reasons.
Have you ever gotten into a scrape in a foreign country?
Well, while I was in Palestine, and this was just a couple of weeks ago, this is when the shooting and then the subsequent insertion of security gates in the old city of Jerusalem was happening. And I don't want to get into the politics of Palestine, but when you talk to Palestinians, this, what they call the Israeli occupation, the anger and frustration, it doesn't take much to bring it up in conversation. And so I'm listening to all the news about what's going on in Jerusalem and going, is this going to erupt throughout the territory? And am I safe?
And I would think there have been other countries where you might have questioned your safety.
Oh, always. I mean, in Guyana, I was told, don't go out by yourself. And there's a very cool open-air market. And it's like a lot of markets around the world. But I knew that if I walked, I was going to get mugged.
But you love it so much, you keep going out, you keep traveling.
Yeah, well, you know, there's always, you know, the hotels I stay at are reasonably well looked after. And if I have to put myself under a self-imposed hotel arrest, it's fine because I can sit in the bar or just read or, you know, I'm working on a new book, so I take time to write, you know, work on that. So it's really not a problem.
You're doing a lot of things, but what's interesting about your work is when you talk about donor agencies, the big ones are, you said, the United States Agency for International Development and UNDP, the United Nations Development Program. they go in and help with a lot of infrastructure, but where you come in is the branding and the marketing. They right. need you to do that part.
What happens, and consider how poor these places are, the farmers barely have the wherewithal to survive. And so the idea of having modern production equipment for farming, or the processors having modern equipment for that, or even in one case, this was in Ghana, I believe, and I was working with a company that dried grains. And they were provided the dryer, which operates with electricity. They couldn't afford the electricity to dry it. And so I when I got there, they had the screens up on the roof of the building out in the sun. And the dryer was downstairs in the working area. And I said, why aren't you using the dryer? And there are health issues for that. You know, you get bird droppings and insects and things in the grain. And, you know, we're trying to make a better thing. But what they do is when these donor companies, they build capacity, they provide equipment, all kinds of equipment. And then so the producers now have more stuff to sell. How do they sell it? They don't know. Then they just take
what seems obvious to us Americans, maybe, like you slap a logo on a brand.
I don't know. It is to a degree, but I got to tell you, even some of the domestic companies that I work with, you know, they
struggle with it.
They don't understand the branding part either. And so even though I'm working with, you know, people that have nothing trying to make something of their business, I experience the same thing here in the States, where there are people that are emerging and don't have a clue.
Now, you mentioned you're working on a new book. This will be a cookbook featuring recipes from all the places you've lived and worked.
Yeah.
That's kind of cool.
Well, my friend said, hey, you know, I've written two books now, and after the last one came out, my friend said, Jeff, why don't you write a cookbook about some of these places you've been, because you're always writing about or talking about the foods you had. And so when I travel, I try things, and then if it's good, I collect the recipes. So while I was just in Palestine, I've got all kinds of recipes. I've got this garlic paste stuff called toum, and I was comparing notes with the way they make hummus and the way I make hummus. But every now and then, there's something really exotic. And in my last book, it was bearhead hash. You know, it's basically a corned beef hash, but it was what the American Indians did. They would hunt the bear, and then they'd fry it up in some sort of fat and with some veggies and things. And it's corned beef hash, but it's with bear. When I was in Malawi, I'm driving down the side of the road, and there are these young kids, teenagers, holding up these sticks that look like they've got grilled meat on the sticks, and they're just holding it up for sale to roadside for drivers going by. And I looked at it once, and we were going about, you know, 70, 80 kilometers an hour, and I couldn't really see it. And I felt like Tweety Bird going, I thought booty dad. And when I saw
some meat on a stick.
Yeah, and then when I finally saw the guys coming the next time, I took a much closer look, and it was grilled mouse.
Oh,
and so each stick,
that's not going to make it into the cookbook.
Each stick. Well, I've got a recipe for grilled mouse, but it's
you do.
But it's using chicken tenders.
Oh, okay, that I could go with. I can roll with that. Well, go to studiospear.com for more into Jeff Spear's fascinating life and work. Thanks for being here.
Thank you. It's always great to be here.
Culpepper's up next. Stay with us.
I've managed to channel my rage into humorous commentary on the economy. BBC News wanted to know what I thought about the economic crisis. I was speaking for Ireland.
Join us for more True Stories Told Live. This week, it's a live show from Dublin, Ireland on the Moth Radio Hour from PRX.
Saturdays at 3 on 89.9 WJCT.
Get your tickets for Girls' Day Out now. Join WJCT and Baptist Health for a day of pampering and making time to care for you. Be inspired by health experts, free screening, fresh food, and great door prizes. Saturday, August 26th, 7:30 to 3 p.m., Hyatt Regency. Tickets are $40, but space is limited. For information, go to wjct.org/girlsdayout.
If a hurricane threatens our state, Florida's public radio stations have joined forces to ensure you receive important storm information. No matter where you are, you can stay informed on the radio, online, on social media, and on the mobile app Florida Storms. Timely weather information is always available from WJCT. The Florida Public Radio Emergency Network is supported by Citizens Property Insurance. Online at citizensfla.com.
Welcome back. Well, finally, this hour, with just two preseason games remaining, the Jaguars find themselves embroiled in a bit of a quarterback controversy.
I'm a pepper, he's a pepper, she's a pepper, we're a pepper, wouldn't you like to be a pepper too?
Cole Pepper has more on the drama happening over at Everbank Field. Hey, Cole.
Good morning, Melissa. Yeah, you know, when your town has a quarterback controversy, it can grip the entire city. And in a football-aware town like Jacksonville, it can become the topic of conversation. If you think back to the quarterback controversy of 2007, when it was Leftwich or Garrard, seemed like everybody had an opinion one way or another. Uh-huh. You'd hear it at dinner, you'd hear it at church, you'd hear it, walking down the street, overhearing, a couple of accountants talking on the corner, because that's where accountants like to hang out, obviously, is on the corner.
Of course.
When Blaine Gabbert had his struggles and started to flame out, there wasn't an obvious solution right away, but everybody kind of knew it was time for him to go. And now Blake Bortles, who has had the struggles, Thursday night's game in the preseason against the Buccaneers, Bortles, you could just see it, didn't look the part, and Doug Marrone saw it as well. And he publicly proclaimed after the game that the position was up for grabs. So here we are, week one of the Jaguars quarterback competition. But the question is, how long will it take for them to sort this out? It could go on more than just this week. Bortles and Chad Henne are splitting time with the first team in practice this week, and it will be telling to see who comes out first on Thursday night against Carolina. That should provide an indication of who Marrone thinks has the inside track on the job.
What do you think?
Well, I think it's going to wind up being Chad Henne, because I think if your starting quarterback, who you invested a draft pick in, who you've had for so long, doesn't look the part, it's probably not going to turn around in a hurry. And I talked to Bortles after the game on Thursday, and he kind of said, listen, I made a couple of bad passes and we didn't run the ball very well. And the way he was describing, I mean, he said the right things from a, soundbite standpoint, but when you stand there and you talk, and you've done this before, you talk to somebody, you gain a lot of sort of secondary nonverbal information. And I think he's frustrated by the fact he doesn't think that he should lose his starting position, which he officially hasn't yet, just the competition is open. But I think he thinks that there's more going on here. Mm-hmm. And honestly, he had a terrible year last season. Part of it was due to injury. Part of it was due to his performance. Part of it maybe was due to some people around him, wide receivers dropping passes, offensive line not playing particularly well, running game not being very effective. But this year, worked in the offseason, tried to get back to improving his mechanics. But it's not just the mechanics that are the issue right now. It's missing open receivers, and there is a growing sort of undercurrent of issues going on within the team, where you have things like Jalen Ramsey liking an Instagram tweet of a story saying that these are the six quarterbacks the Jaguars might be interested in if they move on.
That's a little bit of shade, isn't
it? It is. And listen, in this day and age, we could talk about whether that's a smart thing for Ramsey to do or whether he should even be following these things. But everybody's going to see that. I mean, all sure. Somebody's got to do is take a screen grab of the thing, and even if he unlikes it 5 minutes later,
Too
late. It's out there. The internet is written in pen, not in pencil, right? Mm-hmm. And that's exactly what happened.
Imagine the locker room vibe with
right.
all of this going on.
So that's exactly the question. So I went and yesterday went into the Jaguars locker room and asked a number of players about how they were dealing with. There's so much kind of noise in the system right now, we call it. There's so many things being talked about outside of the Jaguars locker room. I asked a number of players what it was that they were dealing with, and listen to what offensive lineman A.J. Cann, Brandon Linder, wide receiver Allen Robinson, and defensive end Calais Campbell, who's really one of the vocal leaders on this team, said about trying to insulate themselves from what's going on outside of the locker room.
Whether it's Blake, Chad, Brandon, at the end of the day, you got to do your job. I'm pretty sure whichever quarterback it is, they'll take care of that business just like we have to like a team.
So in terms of going through, how is this in practice when you've got different guys behind you? How is it different for you?
I mean, it's not different at all. I mean, it's just we're all on the same page, and I mean, we're going to make it work.
At the end of the day, we're all one team. We're all fighting for the same goal, and that's to win games. So, I mean, each and every day we line up, we get in that huddle. I mean, we just listen to the play call, go out there and do our job. You know what I mean? It's only so much that you can control in this league.
You know, good teams don't let the noise affect you. You know, you can't listen to the outside world. I mean, you know, I mean, that's your job, is to go out there and create stories and figure out what's going on and all that good stuff. But our job is to play football, you know, line up and get our job done, you know, and we try to do our job just like you do yours.
That's Calais Campbell at the end. He's a veteran, and you can tell he's a guy with some perspective. He's been in the league a long time. He's played at a high level. He's one of the big free agent signings in the offseason, and he knows that these things are swirling around. He's aware of it. I mean, listen, they can say we don't read the papers, we don't listen to the radio, we don't watch TV coverage, we don't go online, but it's
but they know. They know. And what about all this chatter that they're going to bring in another quarterback, even Colin Kaepernick?
Yeah, Colin Kaepernick. Colin Kaepernick is one name that has come up. And I would say this about bringing a quarterback in at this point. First of all, setting aside the fact that it would be shocking to me if Tom Coughlin would make the decision to bring in a player who would bring more distractions at this point of the season. That's not what a Tom Coughlin kind of move is. You know, he's had these moves where he's brought in players who he thought could help the team but were, you know, questionable. R.J. Sauer draft comes right to mind back in the day. But I don't think this is the time that Tom Coughlin wants to introduce more distractions into the team. That just it doesn't feel like the kind of move that would make sense. The other thing is, at this point of the season, bringing a quarterback in and expecting him to start any time in the first, say, half of the season, that guy would already have to understand your offense, have to have worked with the offensive coordinator. And so those kind of guys are somewhat limited. And I don't see the Jaguars making a big move as far as that's concerned. However, we'll see how it all plays out. And all the drama is going to be Thursday night when the Jaguars host Carolina in the third and most important preseason game.
And by the way, speaking of all of this football drama, you don't want to miss the premiere of a really exciting new television show here in Jacksonville. It's going to debut tonight on the CW at 7 p.m. The Mark Brunell Show, live from Sneakers at the Beaches. And guess who's going to be part of the roster? Cole Pepper.
Yeah, it's
going
to be fun and great to have Mark there to comment, who's been through some quarterback controversies.
That's right.
To comment on what's going on.
So make sure to tune in tonight and see Cole, Mark Brunell, and the rest of the team. It's the Mark Brunell Show. That's going to be great as the season kicks off. And we're out of time. I know the Armada and a few other sports news and notes you wanted to talk about, but just follow Cole on Twitter for that, at Cole Pepper. Good to see you. Have fun tonight at Sneakers.
Thanks, Melissa.
And that's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Kevin Murchard. Michelle Corum runs the board. The show theme, composed by the Jacksonville Symphony's Pyotr Chevchik. Next on 1A, can faith leaders help America heal after Charlottesville? I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT-FM Jacksonville, your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.